This is Block by Block, a community news program from WPPM LP 106.5 FM, where we explore issues affecting the Philadelphia area with news reports from members of the community. I'm Milan Parker.
And I'm Anaya Davis. In the next half hour, we'll hear stories from our community news reporters about a massive protest in Philly during the country's bicentennial anniversary 50 years ago, an artist whose work brings past and present together, and why an award-winning cheesemonger pushes a cheese cart from table to table at one Philly restaurant.
But first, the Pennsylvania primary election is coming up Tuesday, May 19th. This year, voters will pick their party's nominees for governor, lieutenant governor, and Congress. There are also races for state Senate and House seats. But one race that people often overlook is for a position that can also have a big impact. Block by Block reporter Charlie Klein brings us this story about candidates running to bring change to the Democratic City Committee.
Do you know who your committee person is? They're the people who leave those flyers in your mailbox from the Democratic and Republican City Committees endorsing candidates with big green check marks. Lots of busy voters use them as a cheat sheet going into the voting booth. But who's really in charge of making those endorsements? And what if it could be you or your neighbor making that call? Philadelphia is broken up into 66 wards, and each ward is broken into divisions. And each division could be as small as a city block. So throughout the city, there are 1,703 of them. And all those divisions can be represented by two committee people from each major political party. And those are the people responsible for getting out the vote, sharing endorsements, and running the local polling place on election day. And they can have a big say in who gets endorsed. And right now, there are a lot of vacancies, and it's super easy to get your name on the ballot. You only need 10 signatures from your neighbors, or you can just tell people to write in your name. Some Philadelphians aren't happy with the way the Democratic City Committee makes decisions, so they're running for committee seats in hopes of changing the system from the inside. Mercedes Murphy is one of these people. She's really passionate about her community in Port Richmond, and she's running for committee person as part of a group called Wards That Work.
I've always been kind of interested in the politics of the city, especially in light of the first Trump administration. I wanted to know how I could help, and I figured things would be more effective at a really local level. So when this election cycle rolled around and I saw that there was potential for change in our local ward, Ward 25, I was really excited to get involved. I was mostly upset that the local Democratic Party seems really stagnant and not really listening to people on the ground. And I just think that you can't change this party from the outside. You have to take it over from the inside.
One reason Mercedes and other candidates are running with Wards That Work is because they think the current system has shut out progressive candidates for office. For example, when Working Families Party candidates Kendra Brooks and Nicholas O'Rourke ran for city council, the Democratic City Committee, or DCC's chairman Bob Brady, led an effort to expel committee people who endorsed them, even though they were seeking council seats that are typically held by Republicans, not Democrats. Wards That Work is hoping to make it easier for committee people to have a say in endorsements. Right now, only 10 of the city's 66 wards are considered open, meaning that all committee people vote on the political candidates they want to endorse. But the other 56 are closed, which puts those decisions in the hands of the ward leader and the chairman, who has held that position for four decades. Emma Glazer is part of the Wards That Work communications team. She says it's not just city council races that are affected by this.
I think you also can see, if you're looking at, for example, the congressional district race, Sharif Street has the endorsement of the DCC, and therefore many of the closed wards follow. Whereas Chris Rabb has endorsements from some of the open wards. So you can see that like the progressives are more likely to be getting potential endorsements from open wards, whereas the people who have long-term relationship establishment relationships within the DCC are going to be getting, most likely be getting those DCC endorsements.
This is Mercedes Murphy's first time running for office, and she's been going door to door in her neighborhood to ask people to support her bid to join the DCC.
People are very frustrated, rightfully so. One person by national politics, the loss of jobs from promised manufacturing, that's just not happening. So we had a nice long talk about that. Another person who's actually heavily involved in his block, he's an unofficial block captain. He goes to committee meetings, but he doesn't think that official roles do anything and that more being in the background is more helpful. And talking to him about the wards, I was like, there is a pathway to get some direct engagement with our politicians and influence them. And, you know, politicians listen to the wards because the wards help turn out votes. And that's all they really care about. Some very cynical people in power really care about that. So talking to him and realizing that there is a very approachable way for everyday people, working class people, to get involved on the ground, he was actually very happy to hear about that.
Mercedes says her campaign has had a really positive impact on her entire relationship to her community.
It's been great. I've been here for about 4 years now, like I said, and this is the most I've gotten to know my neighbors since I moved anywhere in the city. There's group chats, there are bike rides plans, there is activism about other issues plans. So I'm getting to know my neighbors as people, and also this is feeding into other causes that we care about in Port Richmond and Kensington: street safety, bike safety, trash, just quality of life issues. It's been really great, especially in our very individualistic and isolated culture. It's been really great connecting to other people and getting to know them as my neighbors and friends.
Mercedes says since people often don't pay attention to ward politics, they may not realize how much of a role city committee members and ward leaders can play during election years. But why is this year's election in particular so important?
Coming out to vote on election day, I mean, that's your time to show your voice. That's your time to speak up and voice your opinion, how you think this party in the city should move going forward. Are you happy with the status quo, or do you want to see something shift in the city's political process? One of the strongest ways that you can show your discontent with the city's party is coming out on election day and voting for the wards that were candidates on your ballot.
Something else I would maybe just say is we're going through the budget season. We've seen in this past year back and forth in city council about safe and healthy homes. Last year, I believe we saw the Power Act that Kendra Brooks pushed forward, right? So when we can think about these policies that are constantly going through city council and who are we sending to city council, it really depends what type of policies are going to affect our daily lives. And those are policies that affect people's, you know, housing, affect people's jobs as domestic laborers, so on and so forth. The budget affects all areas of life, right? And so who are we sending into office, whether it's city, state, federal, can be completely informed by either letting the machine do its thing or, you know, changing things.
You can find out more about Wards That Work and their campaign at wardsthatwork.com. The Pennsylvania primary election is Tuesday, May 19th, and the last day to register to vote in the primary is Monday, May 4th. From Block by Block, I'm Charlie Klein.
Philadelphia will be the center of attention this summer as the country commemorates 250 years since the signing of the Declaration of Independence. But many people feel the country hasn't lived up to the promises made in that document, at least not for everyone. And that's not a new idea. 50 years ago, tens of thousands of people took to the streets of Philadelphia to protest the celebration of America's 200th birthday. Winter Schneider spoke with some of the people involved in that 1976 protest about their efforts to preserve the history of the march and to carry on its legacy today.
Organized by the Puerto Rican Socialist Party, the July 4th coalition turned out between 40 and 60,000 people to march for a bicentennial without colonies, for full democracy, equality, jobs, and a decent standard of living for all. It was what historians considered to be the largest political demonstration since the end of the Vietnam War the year prior, and it brought the issue of Puerto Rican independence to the fore. July 4th, 1976 was a Sunday. After a service at the Church of the Advocate, led by Father Paul Washington, the march assembled at 29th and Clearfield in North Philly, before walking a two-mile route through Strawberry Mansion that ended up at 33rd and Oxford Street.
It was a beautiful day. There was such a diversity of, you know, some people carrying giant Puerto Rican flags. There were a lot of handmade signs with the slogans.
Tony Hariza was a recent college graduate and member of the New American Movement in 1976, when he helped organize a broad coalition of groups to come to the march in Philadelphia from Dayton, Ohio. He's now part of the July 4th Sin Colonias Coalition, working to build a living digital archive of the anti-bicentennial march in 1976. Paul Sokolar is another member of the group. He participated in the march as a rising senior at Haverford College, and remembers another aspect of that day 50 years ago.
The march was in the face of a massive police presence all along the route. There were actually sharpshooters on the roofs of houses. In the face of all that, it was a protest that went off entirely peacefully.
And joyfully, which not all political demonstrations at that time had that. And this had an interesting energy because it was this optimistic, powerful, you know, feeling of people together, but with aspirations is really how it felt.
Imagine a huge mass of people made up of different contingents, all chanting chants and singing songs whose lyrics were repurposed for the occasion.
Independencia para Puerto Rico.
Stand up. Stand up for your rights.
Gay, straight, black, white, same struggle, same fight. At that time.
That was radical.
Was radical, yeah. It's hard to overstate the level of excitement and energy at this march. It was just, you know, I think the combination of it feeling huge and incredible, diverse crowd, particularly the enormous Puerto Rican contingent. It was so exciting.
I asked Paul and Tony to give me a sense of why an anti-bicentennial march felt important at that time in U.S. history.
There were revolutions all around the Third World that were winning. You know, it was a time where it really made sense that we had a sweeping and ambitious program of demands, of a vision of really a different nation. The U.S. was in crisis economically and very polarized culturally. You know, it was not a good time to be poor person or a working person. So the bicentennial hoopla did not resonate.
It was really a call for a real democracy rather than celebrating just the mythology of democracy.
In the months before the march, then Philadelphia Mayor Frank Rizzo requested that 15,000 federal troops and then the National Guard come to Philly to handle what he painted as a threatening and violent protest. His request, though ultimately denied, shows how leaders of the march were labeled as threats to American democracy.
I'd forgotten how much they used that, but it became the thing like Puerto Rican terrorist, right? Like that's not a current, it's these associations. Now it's, oh, you support Gaza, terrorist. But it's the same kind of sweeping thing.
It was a march that was led by black and brown people. And this was such a clear case of the effectiveness of a Puerto Rican organization.
On the occasion of this year's semi-quincentennial, organizers of the July 4th Sin Colonias Coalition hope that learning about the 1976 march can spur critical reflection about our present conditions.
These historic milestones are opportunities to contest the narrative. The effort to try to remind people of this march is about that we can do that, that that's important work, and that we need to correct the false narratives about our history and talk about things like colonialism.
In our interviews, it felt clear that one of the most memorable aspects of the march was how it brought together a coalition of groups that hadn't been united before.
It generally was people who I knew, but we weren't necessarily united in a thing, right? We were kind of allies, but separate. And so this, for this time period, we were in a thing together. This was really a focus on a really massive change and overtly socialist politics, not for everyone in the march, but that was the ethos. And if these various communities came together, it's the kind of power that causes change. It still gives me hope that this can happen and that this is the way in which change really will happen. So I'm really happy to be part of sharing this experience with people.
You can keep up with the coalition on their Facebook page. Just search for July 4th Sin Colonias Coalition. This spring will feature events where the group hopes to connect with others who experienced the march in 1976 and to introduce this history to a new generation. For Around the Block, I'm Winter Schneider.
What do we leave behind? And who will remember us? Block by Block reporter Ahmed Hassouna brings us this story about a Philadelphia artist who explores that question through materials, memory, and history in her latest exhibition.
Artist and hand embroiderer Santé Johnson brings together art, activism, and community. Her latest exhibition explores the connection between past and future through deeply personal work. I met up with her recently to learn more.
Right now we're in Tiger Strikes Asteroid in the Crane Arts Building, and this exhibition is called How Will Our Ancestors Find Us? This exhibition is a series of landscapes that are basically the ground to the sky, and it shows the color patterns related to connectivity. By noticing the subtle details, you can sort of pick up on your own narratives.
The work invites viewers to slow down, to look closely, and uncover the histories held within it. Drawing from Native and African roots, her work connects personal memory to a broader cultural history.
The opening piece of this exhibition is related to Sarah Howard, who was born in 1823. She lived in an artisanal community of free African Americans. She had pretty much done everything right. She married a free man. They had their own money. They owned their own house. They had kids. She lived and she died well.
Santé feels a deep connection to Sarah Howard's story. As someone who is both Native American and African American, her own story is shaped by the legacies of enslavement and the journey toward freedom, something she continues to navigate today. In translating Sarah Howard's story into her work, Santé carefully chooses her materials where memory takes shape through layers and fragile elements are transformed into something lasting.
I embroidered her on silk, and then I applied that embroidery onto paper because we think of paper as something that's very temporary, but paper can actually live longer than other materials if treated well. I put a lot of beads and collages of different colors to show the vastness of the Americas in my mind. So I was using this piece of paper to kind of make some color field experiments. And on top of the color field experiments, I wanted to add other community members that would have already been on this land, which would have been the First Nations people or Native Americans.
Materials have always carried meaning in art, sometimes beyond what the artist originally intended. Santé says that in the 19th century, those who could afford it would commission silhouette portraits to reflect a life well lived in America.
It was very common to have like an ivory and alabaster silhouette of yourself. And the thing that I think that's really interesting about it was that the alabaster and the ivory, which is elephant ivory, they would have came on the same slave ships to America. And this person still saved their money to present themselves in the same light that other people in America were also showing how rich they were.
The Sarah Howard piece serves as both a foundation and a key to the exhibition. Its smaller scale opening the door to the theme that unfolds throughout the space. From there, visitors encounter works on wood and paper along with collage and video. Despite differences in form, size, and material, each piece echoes that central work. One theme ties it all together: memory, a way of understanding the past, shaping the future, and creating something that lasts.
Memory is a very important part of my work because if you don't go to the past and understand the past, then you're not creating a pathway to the future. The way that I work my art collection is the art that I make is my own money to express myself and use it the way that I choose. So selling something in the present it doesn't really concern me if you're not going to archive the work.
Santé Johnson's embroidery work extends beyond the gallery. She's part of a team that creates the presidential flag, where her work becomes part of the nation's history. But her practice doesn't stop there. It moves between institutions and lived experience, where art and activism are inseparable.
I don't think that art and activism are separated. I think they're one and the same, because art is always telling the story of a people and the emotional effects that are felt in society at a time. So you can't really disengage from society because you're living in a society in a time. And whatever you're sharing through your creative practice is going to be in tandem with the time. So they're very parallel, I believe.
She reflects on how people come here to build a life driven by dreams of the future, and how resilience and the meeting of cultures continue to shape American identity.
I see myself as an American that is always looking for balance in the American identity, and how the contrasting of different cultures work to shape the American identity.
In the end, her work reminds us that memory doesn't just live in the past. It depends on what we choose to carry forward. For Block by Block, I'm Ahmad Hassouna.
Philadelphia has lots of cheesy businesses, like a woman-run cheese school, a 24/7 cheese vending machine, legendary cheese shops like the Bruno Brothers, and plenty of restaurants serving all kinds of cheese plates. But there's only one restaurant in Philly where the world's best cheesemonger serves a tableside cheese board experience. Alicia Miranda introduces us to the woman who's behind this roaming cheese cart.
Hi, I'm Amelia. I'll be your personal cheesemonger for the evening.
That's Amelia Del Barro. She's an award-winning certified cheese professional. And on Fridays from 6 to 9 p.m., she pushes around a cheese cart at Urban Farmer, a farm-to-table steakhouse on the Parkway.
We have an assortment of 9 different cheeses here. Over here in this corner, this is the least intense of the selection. So we have our Blumy Rind cheeses, things like Brie, Camembert, Triple Cream, if you're familiar with those kinds of categories. And then as we move along the board, it gets more and more intense until we end with our blue. So you can pick 3 or 5. I will plate it up tableside for you, and then we have a selection of accoutrements, and you can have as many or as few of those as you like.
Guests don't need to make a reservation for the cheese cart. They tell their server or wave down Amelia if they're interested.
Hello. Just wanted to let you guys know that we have the rolling cheese cart out tonight. Just for the next few hours, if you're interested in some tableside cheese boards, hearing a little bit about the selections, please let me know.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Amelia introduces people to new cheeses, invites them to ask questions, talks about pairings, and prompts additional conversation. It's an interactive performance that she says takes thoughtful preparation.
I bring my own knives. I have some specialized cheese knives that I use to kind of prep all of the working pieces that I'm going to put on the cart. And then I have a separate set of smaller cheese knives that I use on the cart because there's limited space. Set up the cart with all of the cheeses because we always want to serve them at room temperature for maximum flavor and texture potential. I add all of the accoutrements, and then whatever the garnish happens to be, we use a lot of herbs, fresh herbs. Sometimes there's edible flowers. Just trying to make the cart look beautiful but still accessible. Like, I want it to look like a work of art, but I don't want anybody to be afraid to order from it, because the whole point of the cart is to enjoy the cheese and have a nice little treat. It's a very limited selection of cheese, but I like to curate it so that there is something for everyone. I usually say, what are some of your favorite cheeses? Like, what are your favorite styles of cheese? Do you like Gouda? Do you like cheddar? What is it that you like about it? Is it the texture? Is it the flavor? And just try to, like, narrow down what they're looking for, what types of flavor profiles they enjoy, what types of cheeses they enjoy, and then just give them maybe a taste of something on the cart that I have that might please them.
And sometimes she meets enthusiastic guests too.
Were you on the news?
I was on the news.
You were on the news. There was someone else. I saw that.
Yeah.
On 60 ABC, I saw that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so honored right now. This is awesome.
The reason Amelia was on TV, in 2025, she was awarded the world's best cheesemonger and became the first American to win first place at the Mondial du Fromage in France. On a recent day off, Amelia and I met up at a cafe to talk more about her competition experience.
When you win a Cheesemonger Invitational, you qualify to compete in what's called CMI Masters. The Masters competition takes all of the winners from previous Cheesemonger Invitationals, and they compete against each other in kind of a mock Mondial competition. And the top two scorers in that competition become Team USA, and they go to France to compete in Mondial. So I prepared for this competition every single day for a year. And this is a really intense competition. This is not just cutting and wrapping cheese. This is about cheese artistry. This is about celebrating the cheese in ways that American cheesemongers typically do not get to do. Not only was I trying to present beautiful work, but I was also learning new skills in the process, like completely new skills that American cheesemongers who don't do these competitions probably will never need to use. Just for example, some of the challenges that you have to do in Mondial are cheese sculpture, where they give you three random cheeses and you have to create like a complex sculpture with those. One of them is a combination of tastes, which is essentially a perfect bite. They assign you a cheese and then you have to prepare bites for the judges, and they score you on the quality of the pairing and the quality of the presentation, things like that. Cheese transformation, they assign you a cheese and you have to transform that cheese somehow and then incorporate it into what they call a cold dish. And then my favorite and least favorite is the what we call the plateau. And it is a 1 square meter themed cheese display. And last year the theme was shades of color.
Besides being a global cheese champion, Amelia's career has included selling cheese behind the counter and for industry clients nationally at a company called Formaticum. She filled me in on what it takes to be a cheesemonger.
I have a lot of very specific technical skills when it comes to cheese cutting, cheese maintenance, cheese wrapping, just running a cheese counter, all of the logistics of running a cheese counter. Textbook definition of a cheesemonger is someone who specializes in the sale of butter, cheese, and other dairy products. But it goes way beyond that. We also do a lot of stewardship. We focus a lot on salesmanship and service and storytelling. We are the people who represent the cheesemakers who can't represent themselves in these stores.
As for what's next, Amelia is hosting events and classes around Philadelphia and hopes to pass on her knowledge to the next generation.
Hopefully, they're Googling their local cheese shop, they're going to their local grocery store, and maybe trying something new, maybe buying more cheese, maybe talking to their local cheesemonger, maybe they want to go into the cheese industry. I want to see more American cheese champions. My goal right now is to help make that happen.
You can follow Amelia on Instagram at EMDALBERO. For Around the Block, I'm Alicia Miranda.
Cheers. Thank you.
Cheers to you guys. Have a great rest of your night and enjoy Vermont.
Thank you. Congratulations again.
Thank you.
Block by Block is produced by Amadi Braxton, Abby Cruz, Ahmed Hasuna, Cheryl Jones, Charlie Klein, Corinne Martin, Sophia Mattia, Defarby Robertson, Donya Ramadan, and us,
Anaya Davis
and Milan Parker. Donyon Ramadan is our board operator tonight, and special thanks to Winter Schneider and Alicia Miranda for their contributions to tonight's show.
Brad Linder is radio news managing editor for WPPM. Peter Liu is radio operations manager, and Allison Durham is WPPM's radio program manager.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode of Block by Block featuring more stories about issues affecting life in the Philly region. And you can find past episodes of the show on PhillyCam SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, and wherever else you find your podcasts.
Thanks for listening.